This is W.
Finley. Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. America has been having a love affair with low-cost fashion. Cheap shoes and clothes are selling like crazy, but there's another price tag to consider. What's the cost in terms of American jobs lost? What's the cost to the environment when we're using fiber at an alarming rate and dumping colored dye into rivers? And where do all these throwaway garments ultimately end up? Do they ever really go away? Well, those are just some of the questions Elizabeth Klein raises in her new book, Overdressed, The Shockingly High Cost of Cheap Fashion. Elizabeth has written for a number of publications, including The Daily Beast and The New Republic, and she has traveled the world to calculate the real cost of bargain clothing. She also confesses to being a former discount shopaholic, and we appreciate that. Elizabeth, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, Tracy. Thanks for having me.
Well, we've got another Elizabeth with us today. Elizabeth Wellington is here. She is the fashion reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. She's writing an occasional series called Made in America, looking at the trend for sustainable fashion in the Philadelphia region, and she's done a number of pieces on that. A little bit later, we're going to be talking with Sarah Van Aken. She's a Philadelphia-based fashion designer, and she is the founder of Sava, a socially responsible apparel brand, and she'll be joining us a little bit later on. But we want to begin, Elizabeth Klein, talking about your book. Somebody said that your book does for T-shirts and leggings what Fast Food Nation did for burgers and fries, which is quite a statement. What was the impetus for you writing this book?
Well, I mean, I noticed that my shopping habits had been transformed pretty dramatically over the last, I'd say, 10 years. I got to a point where I really wouldn't buy anything over, say, $20 or $30. I was just very, very cheap when it came to clothes. But then I started to dig into it and realize that this is the way a lot of American consumers shop today. We're buying about one garment per week on average now as a country, and I think that that's a really dramatic shift, and I wanted to look into, why those changes have come about.
And so you found some pretty alarming things. Let me go back to the fact that we are buying clothes in such large numbers. I think you said something like 64 pieces a year?
Yeah, actually, more recent statistics put the numbers closer at 68 garments and 8 pairs of shoes a year. It's a pretty shocking figure, and especially when you think about, how that adds up year after year, which is, I think we can see that in our own lives. Like, how many people do you know, and I'm including myself in this, whose closets are just clogged, overflowing with clothes, and a lot of it we don't wear, and, it's getting rapidly discarded. So we're just really trapped in this cycle of buying and tossing clothes.
Well, yeah, and Elizabeth Wellington, I'd like you to speak to that, to this whole notion of disposable clothing. There was a time when you would buy something to last, but not so much now.
Yeah, it's interesting, Elizabeth, that you just said that. I just cleaned out my closet and got rid of a whole closet's worth of clothing. Almost embarrassing. But what has happened is that we got caught up in, what really pushed it was sort of Target and Kmart and Walmart, and these sort of were doing such fast, H&M were doing such fast fashion at a high rate. They were copying the things that were seen on the runways and putting them into our closets really quickly. So interestingly enough, we thought that we could get this great dress. It was, like you said in your book, Michelle Obama was wearing it. It was Jason Wu for Target. We run out and buy it. It doesn't necessarily last that long, but we don't care because there's a certain rush that comes with finding like that perfect dress, that you think is perfect, that you saw in Vogue 2 weeks ago, but now you can get it at Target really quickly. So I'm just as bad. I mean, you just get a rush and it's like, oh, I got this great dress. And it's, sometimes it does fall apart. Sometimes it doesn't. I think that sort of depends on how people take care of things, but it's sort of, it's become interesting. And that's sort of what we're sort of trained to do right now.
Yeah. Well, Elizabeth Klein, you talk about the 7 pairs of slippers or flip-flops or something at Kmart and sort of
the
adrenaline
canvas,
rush.
The seven pairs of canvas shoes that I bought at Kmart. That was the moment that really, set me on the journey and was like, okay, I really need to look at this logic. Like, I never really got into the designer collaborations, but I was more of the person who would buy, a tank top in every color because they were $4 a piece, That was more of my logic, kind of like stockpiling clothes, which is, another kind of cheap fashion consumer, and certainly one that I also address in the book.
And you kind of don't care if those $4 tank tops, if you don't have them again next summer, you toss them because they were so cheap, you get a bunch more next year.
Yeah, exactly.
A couple of things that I think are interesting that we want to talk about here, and that is Elizabeth Wellington, and I'll ask both of you this. You know, for the average person, given the economy that we've been in for the last several years, buying clothes at Target, at H&M, at Forever 21, at Charlotte Russe, becomes very attractive, particularly for younger people who are really working on limited budgets. But I can hear people saying, wait a minute, you know, who can afford to buy their clothes at Nordstrom or these high-end boutiques, given the economy that we're in? So isn't it out of necessity that we're, you know, buying these kinds of clothes? And I'll start with you, Elizabeth Wellington.
I think it started out of fashion. I will honestly say that I think people wanted to look chic quickly, and they wanted to look fashionable, and they also wanted to look fashionable at a lower cost. Then post Sex and the City, post the quick high fashion, we're all fashionista movement, the economy tanked, and now, you know, we're now addicted to buying things that are fashionable with a label on it that we all know that is now that now costs less. But it's really interesting how it's starting to shift, because fashion is really at the beginning of things that are made here and things that are better, that it's going to be really chic. But we're sort of at the beginning of that, because now we're having to re-educate the customer, mm-hmm. who is so used to, in my grandmother's day, there are dresses that she still has. Of course, we talked about sizing and labeling and that entire, you know, her 8 is today's 10 or her 10 right. is today's 8. I forget how it goes, but there's that. But there were times when people would buy one dress, two dresses, it'd be a really well-made dress. And it was, you know, and it didn't matter if you were seen in that dress a couple of times. Now we're at the point where it's like, well, I'm on Facebook. You can't see me in this dress again. I'm on Twitter. I'm wearing all these different clothes. So right. now you have to, you know, people in their mind think that they have to have a larger amount of clothes. They want to be fashionable and they want to get it at a good price. And all of that has fueled our yeah. need to get cheap fashion very quickly and trendy mm-hmm. and fashionable. But it's gonna shift. But you just have to re-educate the yeah. public.
Well, and Elizabeth, that's a lot of what your book is actually about. But how do you respond to that, to someone who would see your book and say, well, yeah, you know, I'd love to buy my clothes at an expensive boutique or something that's maybe more sustainable but more expensive, but the reality of my budget is that Target is where I'm going.
Well, I mean, the what I always say to consumers like that is, I mean, your goal should be to buy what you need, or buy things that you really love, and take care of what you buy, even if it is from Target. But I would say, you know, adding to what Elizabeth has been talking about, I think that one of the reasons why we're so sort of drawn in by cheap clothes is because consumer knowledge of clothing has gone down so much, I would say, in the past two generations. And what I'm talking about is, you know, people don't really know a lot about fabrics, they don't know about sewing, and they don't know about craftsmanship. So they're really kind of scared, I think, a lot of times, to buy at a higher price point, because they have a hard time knowing when they're getting their money's worth. Mm-hmm. And I mean, consumers are smart enough to know that there are a lot of, you know, quote unquote, higher end brands out there that, where the quality isn't there necessarily, and they don't want to get ripped off. And the marketplace is very confusing. You've got these designers selling $1,000 dresses on one end of the spectrum, and it really makes consumers sort of be like, well, I'm just going to make sure that I'm not paying a lot for clothes, because that way I know for sure that I'm not getting ripped off.
Yeah, Elizabeth Wellington is nodding as you're talking about that.
But one of the other things that's happening because of this movement, you have local designers, Sarah Van Aken is coming here, and the price points may not be as high as something you may find in Bloomingdale's and Neiman's,
right.
but the labels aren't ones that we know as well either. So that's where we're starting to re-educate the public as far as looking at your local tailor, your local designer, someone that's here that is making and manufacturing their clothes. Part of the reason that people don't understand how clothes are made is because those manufacturing jobs are gone.
Yeah.
People don't sew anymore. For example, my mother sews. I hate sewing. She can look at clothes and she can look at a seam, and she knows good fabric, so she can actually pick out good clothes at your Macy's, at your different stores, because she is aware of it. But those jobs, and she wasn't a seamstress, but those seamstress jobs, that information that was passed down naturally because they were good jobs are gone now because of how things are manufactured. So, right, Elizabeth, we're in this world where we don't know good clothes. We don't know fabrics. But one of the things that's interesting is that because after this whole Project Runway movement, we've got these designers now who are coming out of school and they know clothes and they know designing, but they can't make their clothes anywhere because the manufacturing plants are closed now. So they're looking for ways to actually make clothes that are closer to home with lower minimums and that are well crafted to partly re-educate the public. So you're absolutely right, Elizabeth, but I think it's starting to shift. It's just going to take some time for people to be able to really appreciate it when you're used to buying like a $6 V-neck red t-shirt at 20 of them.
Exactly. And Elizabeth Klein, I'm just thinking that won't there always be a market and accompanying pressure for those garments that are produced, I think you talked about like the 2-week life cycle, because even though, you know, I can see working adults, even young adults, embracing the sustainability idea, but on the other hand, you have a lot of young people who really are the ones who are keeping the Forever 21s, the Charlotte Russes, the, you know, stores like that in business. And there has been a lot of incentive, you know, to keep turning over these styles every week or two in some cases.
Right. And I think that the reality is that generation is actually, they're pretty conscious and conscientious when it comes to consumption. It's just that the issues that we're talking about right now and these conversations that, you know, the three of us are having, those haven't really been had on a wide-scale level yet. So a lot of teenagers and, you know, young women who are shopping at Forever 21 and H&M and Target, they've really had no reason to curb their consumption or think about what they're doing because the conversations haven't been had yet, but I don't think that that's any reason to be cynical and say that there's not going to be change or that these consumers can't change. And the other thing is that we should also put the pressure on the retailers, you know, if they're the ones that are sort of setting up this disposable trend cycle. And, you know, I think I read that Levi's, for example, will take back denim after 2 years, and I think that they might repurpose it, and I think that a retailer like H&M should absolutely be doing something like that and educating consumers about reusing and recycling and donating clothes if they're going to, you know, be encouraging people on the other end to think of clothing as disposable. You know, that the retailers really need to get in on this conversation about the life cycle of clothing as well.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned H&M because I saw something just this morning that said that they are sort of moving into this whole sustainability arena and trying to use more organic cottons and that sort of thing, and that there will be probably sometime soon a campaign talking about that. So it sounds like there is some movement in that direction. And there's so much more that we want to talk about in this hour. We are talking about cheap fashion. What's the real cost of fast fashion, cheap clothes and shoes? It's more than you might think. We'd love to hear from you. You can chime in and ask your questions or talk about your fashion experiences at 888-477-9499. You're listening to Radio Times, and we'll be back right after this.
Take Us Home supports WHYY. A group of Ethiopian Jews is waiting in Ethiopia for a chance for a new life in Israel. Many have waited for 10 years or more, living in mud huts with no water or electricity. Fukide and his wife are finally told that the wait for their family is over. But if they go, they must leave their adopted son, Worku, behind. Take Us Home is a new documentary film by Eileen LeBlanc, premiering at Philadelphia Independent Film Festival, Thursday, June 21st at 6 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church on Chestnut Street.
This is Jeff Bundy, WHYY's Director of Member Relations. WHYY's fiscal year ends on June 30th. The last 12 months have seen the first anniversary of our Newsworks Tonight program and the 25th anniversaries of Radio Times and Fresh Air. Now is the time to lay the groundwork for the next fiscal year and beyond. I hope that you'll consider making an end of fiscal year donation to WHYY before June 30th at whyy.org. Thanks.
The Philadelphia Museum of Art proudly supports WHYY and presents Art After Five, a blend of jazz and international entertainment every Friday. This Friday, it's Peter Beets, a Dutch pianist with impeccable technique and an incisive sense of swing. Beats has played with Chick Corea, Wynton Marsalis, Elvin Jones, John Clayton, and D.D. Bridgewater, among others, beginning at 5:45. More details are available at philhamuseum.org.
Welcome back to Radio Times. We're talking about fashion. Well, specifically, we are talking about cheap fashion and how it may carry a higher price tag than you might think when you factor in the cost of jobs lost in America, the cost to the environment, even to some degree to our self-esteem. And we'll get to that in a little bit. But we're talking with three fashion experts about this sort of obsession that America has with cheap fashion. We have been talking with author Elizabeth Klein. She has written a book called Overdressed, The Shockingly High Cost of Cheap Fashion. We have another Elizabeth Wellington, who is the fashion writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And now we have with us Sarah Van Aken. And Sarah is a Philadelphia-based fashion designer and founder of Sava, a socially responsible apparel brand. Sarah, welcome to Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I know you've been listening into our conversation, and we were just getting to the point where we were talking about sustainable fashion, and that is really the world where you live right now. Tell us about that.
It is. Well, you know, it's a difficult world. You know, it's impossible right now to have a completely sustainable garment. I would have to grow organic cotton on my roof, you know, organic dyes, pedal sewing machines, and whatnot. So for us, you know, and we kind of look at it comprehensively, you know, people, planet, and profit. So starting with people was the most logical place, so creating local living wage jobs in manufacturing, using fair trade textiles, and if we can get them organic, recycled, sustainable, that's sort of icing on the cake for us. And then community partnerships and impact on the community and nonprofits that help women transition back into the workforce. We have a great partnership with the Career Wardrobe, so we do clothing drives for them, which is great for us because it looks at the end life cycle of the garment. But the truth is, in kind of reiterating what both Elizabeths were talking about, there's a major education component. I mean, people are so far removed, not dissimilar than they were to food 10, 15, 20 years ago, so far removed from how their clothing gets to them and its impact on the environment and really people around the world. And it's kind of staggering. I think that most people don't realize the apparel industry is one of the largest polluters of the environment in the world. Mm. And there's something like 200 million people working in enslaved labor conditions.
Wow. And Elizabeth Klein, you mentioned in China the rivers flowing with colored dye, right?
I saw that in Bangladesh, actually. Mm. But, I mean, the pollution in China, I'll never forget it. I mean, you can't even see in some areas of the manufacturing cities because the smog is so thick. It's pretty extreme.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple of things here. And Sarah, I'd like you to tell us a little bit about how you run your business, because it is not what we might think. I mean, you're not necessarily, you know, getting things from India and all of that. You're doing a lot of stuff locally. Tell us about how you run your business in a sustainable way.
Sure. So we're vertically integrated. So we design, develop, and manufacture everything right here in Philadelphia. And we have a retail store where we sell it from, although now we're also going to be selling through other retailers throughout the Mid-Atlantic. But you know, it's impossible for us to get textiles here in Philadelphia right now. The closest place really is in Allentown. So we do source some knits locally. We try to, really all of our knits are domestic. I think that, you know, unlike food, apparel has a slightly larger footplate. You know, we're not going to grow cotton in Pennsylvania. But we try to source as much domestically. So there are things that we get from overseas. We just ensure that they're at a minimum fair trade. And then if I can, you know, hopefully we can get them sustainable or organic. We have, you know, there's some limitations there in what we're able to purchase. But then everything is cut and sewn here in Philadelphia and sold from here as well.
So you've got pretty much a factory going there, it sounds like.
We do.
And you're doing clothes not just for the average consumer, right? I mean, you've got some businesses, some restaurants, hotels as clients.
Sure. We have three primary channels. So we have Sava, which is our women's brand. So we have a retail store for that here at 17th and Sansom. We sell it online and through other independent retailers. We have a brand called Van Aken Signature. So we design and manufacture uniform programs for celebrity chef restaurants. So front of the house, server, bartender uniforms for like the folks you'd see on TV, Jean George, Tom Colicchio, and people like that. And then we also private label manufacture. As Elizabeth mentioned, it's difficult to find for designers to find places to manufacture in the United States, so we manufacture for other designers and put their label on it as well.
Hmm. Sarah, are you concerned about retraining consumers? We've talked a lot about education here, and to the point where, you know, people have become used to getting bargains, they're used to getting deals, they're used to not paying full price for anything. What do you think it will take to really educate people about why it's important to maybe spend a few more dollars on something that is sustainable, as opposed to, you know, the $4 tank tops that we talked about earlier, and getting them to be willing to part with a little bit more cash for these kinds of clothes?
Yeah, it's incredibly difficult. I mean, part of the start of our job was done, I believe, with the economic crisis, you know, where people started to wake up to what they were doing. They're not buying the multiple tank tops anymore. You know, that's not really an option. So they're starting to think about what they purchase more consciously. They're also starting to have more value-driven purchases. I mean, particularly our customer with Savaz, you know, average age is 45 or 50. So in this realm where they've seen good times and bad times and are becoming a lot more conscious. And but there is, it's a struggle to educate people because some people really just don't care.
Right.
You know, and then it's kind of funny because every garment in our store has a tag that indicates what element is, whether it's local made, whether it's fair trade, organic, recycled, going down the list. And when people come into the store, they get very excited that things are made in Philadelphia, and they have a real attachment to sort of the people part of it, that it's made in America, but very little attachment to whether it's organic or the fabric was domestic or it's recycled.
Well,
It's just a really interesting thing to note about people's mentality about it.
Yeah, and how they approach these things. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering too, Elizabeth Wellington, about, you know, as we move closer to sustainability and you know, businesses like Sarah's really begin to attract more and more people, are designers then going to be in a position where they're going to need to make more sort of classic designs? If people are looking to buy something, you know, the investment pieces, right, that you want to have for a number of years, do you anticipate that we'll see more of kind of classic streamlined looks going forward?
Hi, Sarah. I just want to say hi first.
Hi.
actually, that's happening now. If the runways for spring, well, the runways that resulted in spring 2012, this spring, and the runways for fall 2012, we're all much simpler silhouettes. And I think that what is happening as far as fashion goes, when we were at the beginning of this cheap fashion cycle, things looked very trendy. You know, a pointy-toed shoe, you know, was hot. Ruffles and ruching in places that you never saw it before was hot. But now the silhouettes are much more streamlined. Yes, they're peplums for fall, but, you know, jackets are shrunken and they're smaller, you know, skirts, the hemlines are dropping, maxis, you know, are around, they'll be around for a while. So what I think is happening is, you know, things that you buy this year, you can wear again next year, you can wear again the year after that. So it won't be that need to look so different. I think people are changing it up by adding a lot of color, what is happening in fashion. But one of the other interesting things that I wanted to piggyback about what Sarah was saying is that the general, what's happening, I think, is that less is becoming so much more chicer. People want, you know, more streamlined houses. Their computers
sort of
are getting smaller.
Kind of thing, yeah.
You know, their computers are getting smaller. People are buying exactly what they need at the grocery store and coming home and making a meal. And so I think that this entire movement, it's not, you know, just fashion, it's our lifestyle.
Yeah.
People are choosing to live in cities as opposed to living in cul-de-sacs, so they're not going to have the car. So there's a sense of that the less I have, the better my quality of life can be, because hey, I don't have to spend that much time cleaning it, but it's just simpler. And so I think we're really right at the beginning of that movement. I don't know about you guys, but sometimes I would walk into stores and you'd see racks and racks and racks of clothes, and you start to look at them and go like, God, who needs this much?
Right.
Who's going to buy this much? It's so much stuff.
Who can wear all
this stuff? And I think it's that visceral natural reaction that we're seeing is sort of shifting. Now, yeah. You will have people who say, and I love these people because they say all the time, well, why would I want to buy one thing, you know, at $70 if I can buy five at $440? And, you know, so it's sort of a retraining of what is valuable.
Yeah.
And like I said before, people don't care. If you know, you have to also teach people, if you looked great in that black dress on Monday, maybe you look great in that black dress 2 months from now, too, and if you're seen in it, there won't be the end of the world.
Well, not only that, but you could go into, everything just became so ubiquitous that you could walk into an H&M or walk into Ann Taylor or almost even mm-hmm. Prada, and you see the same black
trends.
Yeah.
You know, and so it just became kind of pointless, where now I feel like it's more about the added value and the story and you know, how important it is to you and your wardrobe and more individual style.
Well, Sarah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Can I jump in here?
Absolutely.
I also wanted to say that I've seen a lot of sustainable designers actually trying to come out with a more unique design vision versus, you know, producing basic wardrobe staples or basics. You know, I'm thinking of designers like Farrell Child or Bodkin. And I think the idea is that if you sell someone a piece that's unique enough and it doesn't look like anything in the stores, that people are willing to buy more, pay more money for it, because I think that, like what Sarah is saying, you can walk into any store and you see the same trends over and over again, and I think people are a little frustrated with looking the same.
Yeah.
And I think that that's another thing that's really driving a lot of consumer movements right now, is people really want that customization, they want a one-of-a-kind piece, and I think that that's where sustainable fashion and slow fashion is going to have its true edge and really resonate with consumers.
Well, Sarah Van Aken, I know we have to say goodbye to you because we've got to let you get back to work, but this is what happens when you get a bunch of women talking about fashion. And I think, you know, Elizabeth Wellington made a great point about how on so many levels we're kind of getting back to basics. And it sounds like for you, you are on kind of the cutting edge of us coming back to basics and really beginning to rethink the way that we buy clothes, how they get to us, where they're from, what the quality level is, that sort of thing. So we wish you the best. And can you just quickly tell us where can people get information? Where's your website if they want to take a look?
It's at savafashion.com.
As in Sarah,
A-V-A fashion.com.
Okay.
Or at a retail store at 17th and Sansom if you're in the Philadelphia area.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Sarah. It was great talking with you.
Thank you.
Well,
have a great day.
Thank you. You do the same. So we've got lots of people lined up who want to talk to our guests. So we'll start off right here in Philly with Susan. Susan, welcome to Radio Times. Sure. Are you there? Are you on a cell phone, Susan?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay,
no, this is
okay.
Susan, yes.
Gotcha. Okay, your comment or question for our guests.
I'm a owner of a small business here in Philadelphia, Viv Pickle Custom Handbags, actually, and been in business here for 12 years. Everything is locally made right here in Philadelphia. Has been the case. I certainly could have outsourced the business and made more money off of it, but that really wasn't what my intent was. And my main comment is that it's great to hear a conversation like this, but the issue that I run into generally... Hello?
We're here. Mm-hmm.
Oh, I'm sorry. The issue that I run into generally is that most of the local media, who you would hope would want to cover companies like mine and like The Last Caller and so forth, they're guided by, you know, advertising purchases, and advertising is very expensive, and small businesses that are trying to do the right thing generally can't afford that. So we kind of get stuck in that we can't get press coverage locally, because we don't play that game, and it makes it challenging for us to be able to compete with those big businesses that are producing for so much less and basically perpetuating what you're talking about today. And I was interested in, you know, what thoughts you all had on that and what can be done to generate that interest locally again, because we need, obviously, the press to help us out as well.
Well, we've got one right here, actually, in the studio with us, Elizabeth Wellington. What do you say to that concern?
Hi, I'm familiar with Viv Pickle. How are you doing?
Great. Thanks, Elizabeth.
One thing I want to clear up, what happens on the editorial side is completely different than what happens on the advertising side. So, yes, it is expensive to buy an ad, and you have to make a decision whether or not you want to buy an ad. But just because you don't buy an ad in the Inquirer doesn't mean that the reporter will not cover your story. Now, sometimes I can speak for myself. I am overworked,
right,
really stressed, and stuff falls through my cracks all the time. So what I'm thinking is now, you know, I didn't know that, you know, you were sustainable. I didn't know that, you know, everything is made locally here. So And at the time, I wasn't working on, you know, Made in America chic, because it wasn't like in my face. So I'm thinking to myself, I'm taking notes, and maybe, you know, maybe she's a person that we would like to, that I would like to cover in, you know, in the series. So it becomes one of those things where, and that's a big, it's a big misconception, and it's hard to get that across to people, that what happens on advertising doesn't really doesn't translate to what happens in editorial. You know, I can respect that.
Can I just make a quick comment?
Mm-hmm.
I that may be the case for certain at the Enquirer, but I have been told directly by editors of certain publications here in Philadelphia, well, you haven't advertised with us, so we figured, you know, we'd move on and feature somebody else. I've heard that from four different local magazines and local newspapers here. Not the Enquirer, I'll state that up front. And I think that's kind of sad because, you know, there is a certain pay to play mentality. You can ask any small business person in town, and I'm all for supporting Philadelphia personally. You know, been here for 12 years. I also support the Career Wardrobe, a great organization. We've been doing that for 10 years.
I want to stop you right there because we have a number of callers, and just for time's sake, I want to just allow our guests to have a chance to respond to the concern that you have brought up here. Part of that, Elizabeth Wellington, I would think is, I mean, there is a certain cost to doing business.
Well, the one thing is, like I said, I can only speak for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and that's, you know, in newspapers and daily newspapers, which is probably part of why we're suffering on some level, is because, you know, there's such a separation between church and state, which is advertising and editorial.
Right.
Now, I can't speak for your glossy celebrity local magazines that you probably all know that you're talking about.
Totally different kind of media.
But that's a totally
that we're
different kind
about.
Of media. And
right.
But like I said, for myself, you know, as Elizabeth Wellington representing the Philadelphia Inquirer, I'm really glad that you called. I really think that what you've said is really on point. You know, I will take a chance and Google, or feel free to call me at my office, at my desk, and leave a message. And then we can talk about, you know, writing a story about you. Because I think, you know, especially with the climate that what's happening now, especially the point that you mentioned about how you were, you could have outsourced and you could have sold your company, but you decided to stay locally here, is a really, that's really what people are thinking about. And that's really what people need to know about. Because like Elizabeth Klein said, when you decide to cheap fashion or fast fashion, you know, yes, it's cheaper, but people, I think what people are really understanding now is that you lose jobs. And if you want, if Americans want to work and Americans want to craft, then we're going to have to bring these manufacturing jobs back. And if you are one of these people who are trying to make it happen, then that's definitely a story that we would want to tell.
Well, we have many more callers, and we'll get to them on the other side of the break. But one thing that I do want to mention and have you talk about when we come back, both Elizabeths, is this, that as we move toward, hopefully, more sustainable clothing, there is that issue. Where does that leave the manufacturers who thrive on volume, who are maybe making very little profit on each particular garment? And so the way for them to survive is they've got to crank out a lot of clothes and sell a lot of clothes. And I think that that's something that, you know, we want to talk about from the manufacturing perspective when we come back. We will take your calls as well at 888-477-9499. I want to talk a little bit, too, about the impact on the environment and ultimately what all of this means for us as wearers of clothes and our self-esteem and how we view ourselves. So we'll talk about all that and much more when Radio Times comes right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. 100 years ago, Leopold Stokowski stepped onto the podium and created what has become known as the Philadelphia Sound. Yannick Nezet-Séguin conducts the Philadelphia Orchestra in Stokowski specialties. Dvorak, Brahms, Scheherazade, Disney Fantasia, and more. High-definition visual effects are projected throughout the Academy of Music. 215-893-1999 for tickets or online. This Thursday through Saturday at the Academy of Music, celebrate Stokowski.
On the next Fresh Air, Jeff Daniels talks about starring as a cable news anchor in the new HBO series, The Newsroom. It was created by Aaron Sorkin, who also created The West Wing. Join us for the next Fresh Air. this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Many of President Obama's health care reforms are already on the books. We'll get a primer. What happens if the Supreme Court rejects all or parts of the bill? Also, the Philadelphia hip-hop duo Chitty Bang on breaking the Guinness Book of World Records for longest freestyle rap, over 9 hours. That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Muscoin. We are talking about fashion and America's obsession with cheap fashion and disposable fashion, for that matter, clothes that don't last very long, shoes the same. But what does that mean in terms of the price tag that it carries for American jobs, for the environment, in many other areas? We've been talking with Elizabeth Wellington, who is the fashion reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. She's also been writing a lot lately about sustainability and about Made in America. She's doing a series on that. We're also talking with Elizabeth Klein, who is a journalist. She's the author of Overdressed, The Shockingly High Cost of Cheap Fashion. And Elizabeth Klein, let me start with you, the question that we raised before we went to the break, and that is, where does all of this leave the manufacturers if we do move toward more sustainable clothing? You know, you've got industries that have grown up around the idea that you do a whole lot of volume, you know, very low margins, but you've got to crank out a whole lot of clothes and sell them. So where does this leave the manufacturers if we go in that direction?
Well, I think you're absolutely right that a lot of the retailers that we're talking about, they wouldn't be able to do what they do without foreign factories. I mean, it wasn't really possible to produce at really, really high volumes that we're seeing. I'm talking about, like, you know, 10,000 to 20,000 pieces of one garment. If it, you know, honestly, if it weren't for China, that's where we have seen a lot of these really, really huge garment factories. And when I was finishing researching the book, I was told that there were some bigger retailers like Target and some of Macy's store labels. They were at least going to do some test runs here, meaning that they would, you know, do the sample garments and then put it out on the floor and see if it would sell, and then do the bigger runs overseas. Mm. So I think I want to put that out there that I mean that whole system is built up around foreign manufacturing, so I don't know how it would work here. But the other thing that I would say is that a lot of bigger mass market shops that were in Chinatown in New York, actually some of the last of those have just closed in the last really in the last 5 years, and it's a garment factory, so, you know, as long as it's not like trying to make sweaters or shoes or something that's a little bit more complex and requires special tools or machinery. You know, if the space is there and people need jobs and you can buy the equipment, then it's certainly not impossible, you know, to imagine reopening bigger garment shops in the U.S.
One question that came in from one of our listeners was this, and it was about men's fashion, Elizabeth Wellington, and the concern that men shop differently than women. Clothes tend to be more expensive, shoes too. So how do we reconcile that with all that we have been talking about? Because when we talk about fast fashion, we tend to think women.
Can I just make one point about the manufacturing?
Yep.
A part of what's happening in manufacturing too is that designers are realizing that they want to make clothing, so they're coming up with cooperative ways to reopen some of the manufacturing plants that have been closed in the last 5 or 10 years. For example, in Philadelphia, the city quietly has been trying to figure out ways that they can bring manufacturing back to the city of Philadelphia. And like you said, a lot of it is about minimums and large requirements. And some of the designers are realizing, well, in China, they want me to make 22,000 pieces. Yeah. I can't make that. I'm not going to sell that. I'm a smaller boutique item. So in order to be able to make smaller runs of pieces and not have to travel back and forth. I mean, people forget that when you manufacture in China, that's like you got to send somebody over there. You have to pay for airfare. I mean, it's a major cost. You have to have somebody sit there on the floor and look at your first sample and see if it works. A lot of designers have terrible stories about how, you know, entire runs came out horribly and there was nothing they could do about it because they were so far. So I think that those movements are trying to get people. Now, Elizabeth is absolutely right in the sense that we're probably not going to see the same numbers that we saw in the 50s and 60s just because our world has changed and there's so many big box stores and there's so many department stores and there need to be bigger runs. But if we continue to cultivate our younger designers and we continue to bring, you know, and they need to make and manufacture in their boutiques and their ways for them to sell, then there will be work here for manufacturing here that's made in America. But back to your question about men's, one of the interesting things about men's fashion is that men's fashion sort of stayed on the smaller scale. For the most part, a lot of your bespoke designers were made and manufactured in America, in Italy, in England. So they were smaller runs. They were classic. There's tailoring with that. So men always complain, oh, women can get clothes cheaper. Well, ultimately, a lot of men's clothing is better made, so it costs more to make it. Now, you do have companies like H&M branching into the men's market, but the truth is men are much more discernible about their clothes. Women, if I see a shirt, a pretty blouse that's sheer, and it has pink and blue flowers, and I want it to wear with my white pants, I'm going to buy it at $15. I'm on it. Guys, they're going to stretch it. They're going to look at it. I only wear polo. I only do this. I only do that. They are much more discernible about their clothing, and manufacturers know that. And they're much more committed to a look. You know, it took men, I think 6 years ago, we saw the streamlined men's fashion look come into fashion. I think I wrote about it 6-7 years ago. Oh, Tom Brown, the designer from Philadelphia, was making those little tiny suits. Every man, I thought, I will never wear that small suit. I will not wear it. I will not wear it. I will not wear it. And it took almost a whole generation of young guys to say, okay, I think I might do that. So now it's hard to do fast fashion with men. But at the same time, they talk about, well, I can't. It's just women have it easier. You know, our mindsets are so much more
different. There are reasons for that.
That's why you have bespoke, you have tailoring, you have men. You know, the guys like to say, and there's something about they say, oh, I come in my 42-inch cuff, they fixed it, it's perfect, I love it. So it's shopping with them and shopping with us is a completely different system.
I know that's right.
And
from
that's
experience.
Why fast fashion with men is, you know, is not, you know, now your younger guys who are probably 20, under 25, they grew up with it. So their system is, they can handle it better.
Yeah.
Guys can't handle quick change in fashion.
Well, let's go to the phones because there are tons of people who want to talk with both of you before we come to the end of the program. We'll go to Doylestown and we'll bring Joanne in our conversation. Hi, Joanne.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
I just wanted to make a comment of something I hadn't heard mentioned by any of your guests. What about the rise in obesity in the U.S. now and its effect on fashion? You talk about purchasing a garment, you know, at 21 or 25 years old and having it last a lifetime. Well, most people aren't the same size over time that they used to be.
So you're raising the question about just the fact that sizes change and that in itself necessitates different kinds of fashion.
The fast fashion trend. You know, people are just, you know, they're not staying at, you know, the same size for their entire adulthood. Yeah.
I actually found out something interesting when I was researching the used clothing market. It's actually becoming very difficult. I write about how, you know, most of the clothes that we donate to charities are resold in the secondhand market overseas, largely in Africa, and it's becoming difficult because the size of American clothes keeps going up. So you're seeing more like 14s and 16s and things like that. And it's actually becoming very very difficult to even find a secondhand market that will accept that overseas. So that's one thing that I found in my research. But the other thing is, if your body changes sizes, that's of course a reason to go out and buy new clothes. I don't think anyone on this show has suggested that you should keep something your whole life if it doesn't fit you. It's about making sure that you buy things that you need and buy things that you love and that fit and flatter your body. We're really, I think, more addressing excess consumption and conspicuous consumption where you're not really thinking about the whole story of your clothing.
Well, we'll go to Germantown next, and Charles. Welcome, Charles, to Radio Times.
Oh, hi. You know, I teach culture anthropology at the City University of New York, and I listened to your question, and I just wondered, you know, clothes have always been more than just clothes, right? They have, they're always sort of infused with this, like, class consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, the question, like, what is the obsession with cheap fashion if people weren't just trying to buy higher class status at a lower cost?
Hmm. Well, I think you raise an interesting point there, Charles. Elizabeth?
Well, that's exactly what they were doing, especially because I guess for so many years, and I preface this with one of my favorite shows is Little House on the Prairie. I have to admit that. And when you watch Little House on the Prairie, one of the things you notice is that they have one good dress.
Yep.
And Ma wears that dress, and she wears it to weddings, she wears it to birthday parties, she wears it to Christmas, she wears it to
church
on Sunday.
Yep.
She wears that dress for two or three seasons. It's the same dress.
There's a lesson there.
So, and that's how we lived. As Americans, that is how we lived. My grandmother had a wonderful sense of style. She was I Love Lucy all day, you know, and she had great clothes, but she had three or four really good dresses, and she wore those dresses, and we saw, and you know, at Christmas time, she got a new dress, and at Easter time, you know, every 3 years, she got clothes, but she didn't wear clothes. Then somewhere in the 80s, volume became very important.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we became corporate, we became, you know, we wanted, you know, moms went to work. When moms went to work, what did moms buy? Moms bought clothes. Dad was buying shoes. Dad was doing the mortgage. Dad was doing things that were necessity. But when mom got that extra paycheck, that money went to clothes. And that showed how well the family was doing. So it became a very important thing about volume. So, yes, you're absolutely right. The problem is that clothes, we started buying more and more and more and more.
Yeah.
And then we couldn't be, I remember in high school saying, I wore that outfit on Monday. People can't see me, not till next month. So we had to have,
Absolutely.
To repeat these clothes. And so you're right, Charles. We were buying status in the volume of clothes. But that is, we're at the beginning of this shift. You know, I could be wrong 10 years from now, but I'm truly thinking that we're going to go back. We want that simpler way of life where, you know, you can live in a smaller place. You don't have to pay $3,000 a month for 10,000 square feet because you need three closets to hold all your clothes.
Right.
And that is starting to shift. So I think you're absolutely right. That's going to shift. But it's what's chic at the moment. So, and of course, by the time we get back to one tiny space and we're all small again, we're going to want more.
And the cycle will start
And the cycle
over
will
again,
start over.
Right? We'll go to
It's interesting. It's interesting, too, that when people knew how to sew, that you couldn't be closed out of the high end of the fashion industry. Because if you wanted a designer dress, you just sat down and you made it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes the craftsmanship was as high as what you could buy in the store.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I know, Elizabeth, that my grandmother worked in a factory all her life. She was a seamstress. And the first thing that she would do when, you know, we would buy clothes, she would flip them inside out, you know, to check the quality.
Too.
And she made many, many an outfit for us growing up. And we thought nothing of that.
But then somehow it became tacky for your mother to wear your clothes.
Yeah,
my
absolutely.
Mother can
And I think
sew,
that's changing again.
She can sew. She can put a hem in so fast. She can iron stuff and put a hem in. And I sit there and look at her like, I can't line up darts. You've got to be kidding me.
Yeah.
So it's what people are learning. So you're right.
Yeah, and maybe of necessity, Elizabeth Klein, there will be a resurgence in that kind of thing.
Well, I think it's like how we all sort of embrace fast food for 20 or 30 years, and then we're like, wait a minute, I think we've lost something in our food culture here. I think that the same thing is happening with clothes. It's like, okay, yeah, we stopped sewing for reasons of time, but it became a symbol of modernity, I guess, to be able to walk into a store and always buy something off the rack for cheap. But now people are like, oh, I actually kind of miss that connection to understanding clothes and knowing how they're put together.
And we got fat.
as our listener pointed out, indeed, we've got a lot of rethinking and returning to do on multiple levels, it sounds like. In our last couple minutes, I'd like both of you to just address our listeners. We've talked about the need for education, retraining, re-education as it relates to clothes. What's the advice that you give to, you know, the average person who is looking to buy reasonably good quality clothes at an affordable price? What should they keep in mind as they're going through that process? Elizabeth Wellington, I'll start with you.
Well, one of the things I had to do when I was shopping, because we talked about that rush, and I would walk into a store and I'd see a dress and go, oh, I have to have it. So what I stopped doing was I stopped buying it at that second and I'd walk away. And if I still thought about it, you know, the next day or 2 days later, then I might come back and get it. That's just to train myself about this about consumption, yeah, about shopping and clothing. But as far as as much as this is all interesting with sustainable fashion, I can't honestly tell you that I won't walk by H&M or I won't walk by Charlotte Russe and go, ooh, that little ruffle blouse is $10 and it's so cute, I must have it. But I also need to go to the Sarah Van Eken stores, yep, and to maybe buy a Vivid Pickle bag and look at these different places and find out about smaller and smaller designers. And if we show retailers that this is what we're interested in buying, then they will stock it.
Yeah.
And that's the bottom line. We have to show retailers that we're willing to spend the money and that we're interested in, and ask. You know, there's a store called Knitwit in Center City. And one of the things I talked to about Anna Gitter, she said people are coming in and asking me, is it made in America? And they're very excited about it. So that's telling her, okay, I need more Three Dots t-shirts because they're made here.
Yeah.
So you really have to, you know, if jobs are important to you and this kind of lifestyle is important to you, you have to demand it from your retailers. Yeah. And then the better quality will come, and then, you know, you'll get less. But it's sort of a shift in mindset.
A shift in thinking, absolutely. Elizabeth Klein, I've got 30 seconds. Your advice to people who are trying to navigate all this.
I agree with everything that Elizabeth Wellington said. Americans spend $1,100 per year on average on their clothing, and you know, people just need to be strategic. Take that money, sit down at the beginning of the year and decide how you want to spend it, and absolutely pressure retailers. I, for example, love Keds, and I just emailed them the other day and I said, I need to know where your shoes are made. Are you making any efforts to make them in the U.S.? And you know, you can still support the brands that you love, mass market brands that you love, but just buy less, buy what you need, and take care of what you own.
Sound advice indeed. I want to thank both of you, Elizabeth Wellington, writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and Elizabeth Klein, the author of Overdressed, The Shockingly High Cost of Cheap Fashion. Thank you both, and to Sarah Van Eken as well for helping us to understand some of the deeper issues as it relates to the way that we shop. Our engineer today was Fred Snyder, and the producers of Radio Times are Debbie Bilder, Susan Greenbaum, Dennis Devine, and Patty McMahon. And I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscoane. Tomorrow